engineering. That's fine, and I didn't get my degree in that story yet. So I sort of discuss it, and in case it's a point, I'd be very happy to participate. But I'm not misyachas to any yeshivas of authority. So please don't take it that way. There's a chazal that says, HaKadosh Baruch Hu Shor Olam HaRishon Dor Dor V'Dor Shov Parnosov. It showed him each generation its manhigim. In I think the same chazal, I believe it's in Torah's Karnim, in Safra, it says also Dor Dor V'Gazlonov. And people are wondering, what does it say Dor Dor V'Gazlonov? So Reber and Brisk once said, because there'll be a door, but this will be manhigim. That's a very, very, very brisk, very, very brisk answer. And it's, I would like to be a little more pshat oriented and prosaic. There is no such thing as an effective manhig, but rather effective manhig is a term relevant to the door. I don't know if Reb Shamshafal Hirsch in Hungary would have accomplished a saving of a dar, and I don't know if the Chassam Sofer in Germany would have accomplished. My feeling is not because I know better, but it's simply HaKadosh Baruch Hu was Shoysel Tzadikim and big people in each place, in each time, and so on and so forth. So what you really need to know is the ideals, and like we spoke about the Tochacha, on the one hand, the ideals are unchangeable. What a Torah is a Torah, that didn't change. But you always need to keep realigning practically what are you going to expect of the Talmud? What are the nisyonos that he's facing? I mean, one of the things I kind of, on a personal level, kind of upset in Eretz Yisrael, there are certain yeshivas that they speak, the Musa Shnashkovich Muslims speak about the Zionists all the time, anti-Zionist. Not because I'm pro-Zionist, I'm upset with it. Whatever my shittas might be on Zionism, but it's not a mocham anymore. That's not, if nobody has an assignment anymore to become an Israeli soldier, so talking about it is, so since you devote all your time about anti-Zionism, other topics that's not the assignment of the Zohar anymore. Nobody that I know of had it's a horror to become a Zionist. That's not where it went to. So by not looking out for the nisyonos of our door, you're shortchanging it. There's a famous verse of the Chazon Ish. The Chazon Ish was a big, he liked Yiddish, and his dream was a cheder in Yiddish, and he did not allow them to make a cheder in Yiddish in Bnei Brak till the Hebrew speaking cheder had been established. And when the old Yishuv came to, people in old Yishuv came to him about Yiddish, Nivrit, he gave them a mussel. He said in Germany before World War II, they had the French generals reviewed the defenses, And they pointed out where to reinforce it. He said they were very bright people, but they reinforced it based on where the army attacked in World War I. And the army didn't decide to attack the same way, so that was the end of the defenses. You can't defend... he said the sign of today's door is not a written Yiddish, and the Mela, that's the wrong place to put it. So I think it takes... On the one hand, a serious cheshbon nefesh of what is it that Talmidim today have issues with? What is the world they're going to live in? Ain't a doma if you're teaching a place like MTA, you know, where realistically the kids know X, Y, and Z, and therefore you have to deal with it. On the other hand, if you're teaching in Lakewood Necheder, it's simply the question is, what are the problems? It's like... When you go in, when you look into a drugstore to see what they're stocked with, a drugstore in Zambia ought to have a different, they should have anti-malaria drugs, and a drugstore in New York should have something else. It's not the same. So it takes a mechanic needs to take a look and see what is your classes and sionos. I want to tell a mice in my mind, I may have said over the years, I can't remember, it's hard. The person in my mind is the image of a near perfect mechanic And a person that I still look up to in a certain, as a shleimistic person, was a Yid. I don't know how many people knew Reb Zeidel Epstein, Zecharei Vracha. Reb Zeidel was my Rebbe in 11th and 12th grades. He was a person who was a Kaddish V'Tahor. He was a tremendous Pikeach. He had two or three milas that are almost impossible to find. His own personal self was tremendous Kedusha and Tara. He said, I have a mission, roll up my sleeves and dirty my hands. And tremendous pikchis about where to direct, where to focus, and so forth. I went to a school that was called RJJ. It was the first Gilgal of what's RJ today. No shaykhs. There's no, the first Gilgal and second Gilgal have no shaykhs to each other. RJJ was a school on par with, we won the same basketball league as MTA, YCQ, JEC. We were the only non-coed school, I think, in that whole lot. And it was a school, and it had in itself Vechash Rashivis, it had itself real epic course of English teachers who did their best to get the kids away from Yiddishkeit. It was amazing, an amazing assortment of things that today couldn't exist. So that was the door. I was 50 years old, 15 at the time. I was a junior probably. And there was a discussion in class about, I think it was legalizing abortion maybe, or something along those lines. And I went over to Rev Epstein, it was my Rebbe at the time, probably already, and I asked him, what's the Jewish view on contraceptives? I mean, this was class discussion, this was very... So he smiled and he said, is it the Gela Maisa? So I said, no. So I said, so why are you asking? So I told him, I came up in class, so he looked at me, thought a few minutes, and he said, sit down. And he explained it all to me. I can't explain it to you, in a matter of fact, he said, you know, this is the mitzvah, this is the chiyuv, this is the issues. He responded, in the world that I was coming to, where in class a teacher could speak about it, and it was considered normal, if he would hide and run behind a shtender or behind his frack, I would come up with a conclusion that it's Yiddishkeit's irrelevant, Torah's not say about it. He spoke to me from A to Z, in a very Bakovnik, a matter-of-fact way, so that I had a very clear sense of things. I mean, and looking back, he was a Yid who was a real Kaddish. But he never, you know, he was extremely big Chacham, understood people, and I was one of the Mises that I relate to, that I wrote about him in the Jewish Observer, and when I made a very tough decision to go off to Yeshiva to learn Eretz Yisrael, he sat down with me, and I'd gone through a lot, and we went through which yeshiva should I go to, is Mir better, is Panovich better, and the Miles, the Sronos. The person behind me was somebody who was basically living in the street, Kamat Nat Frum. He was actually Chava Mind. That was the way the school was in those days. And he sat down with him and went through NYU versus NYU, not YU, we're talking about NYU versus something else in Manhattan, and with the same COVID rosh, that my shaila to go to Mir or to Panovich with the same, you know, there was no difference because this is my nisayon, this is where I have to, and this is this person's issues. It's, so the mechanic needs to have a serious sense of what his issues are and address them. It's important to understand you're not diluting the message. Like I said before, you always want to stress that a person who's sitting and learning is that Torah itself, Shevet Levi, that Moshe Rabbeinu is the top of the mountain. You also want to see where is this person realistically, what's the best place in the mountain for him to sit on? And you know, it's a tough one because you need to keep the ideal in focus and you need to be real with where you're directing the talent. Not an easy yes. Yes.
Sons from Chavrusas in my Lakewood.
Really?
And one of them said, the godless was that, because all the children turned out different.
Yes.
One of them was a butcher, one was in the co-op now, one's a Rebbe, when his daughter married Tversky,
yes.
You know, it's from left to right. Said, our father knew just how far to let us go on our own, but not the extra step. That was the godless. So, you know, there's a tremendous problem, which we're not such people on this side. Not such a PKA to be able to do that. But the question is, how does technology affect your ability as a Rosh Yeshiva in Beis Medrash versus how you could see it in an elementary or high school? And how you handle it, and how you would suggest people handle it with younger kids. I'm sure guys in research have cell phones.
Well, I certainly have cell phones. Problem is, I don't even know everything that they have. They're a Talmud Amachim as Rabbo. I always say, so I think, I'm talking like Echad Mechaverim. What I'm telling you is not, it doesn't have any validity of any of that. On the one hand, when one detects in his Rebbe, or Rebbe figure, or Rebbe, a need to keep up with society, the message is that if I'm always running to get the latest technology for teaching, there's a certain message that they're chashev and I'm running after it. On the other hand, HaKadosh Baruch Hu opens our eyes for technologies and things like that, so that we can keep up with things. I also have a personal aversion. There's a shita like this. We're going to aser everything. We're going to slam on the brakes really hard. And when you slam on the brakes really hard, even after the car gets pushed bal karchach, at least it will be behind, it'll go slower and so on. There's a shita, there's a derech like that. I personally feel that derech lasts two or three times on the brakes, and either the car gives, the brakes give, or the tires give. You can't, so kids realize, yeah, the rabbanim will come round. It's okay. They'll say no, and then they'll come round to it. And in my mind, that is counterproductive. I think people need to, when you speak to kids about the internet, and again, if the kids are old enough so that they have a serious discussion about it, you can tell them, you know, everything HaKadosh Baruch Hu has put into this world, it's Tov and it's Ra. And even Gan Eden had Eitz HaChaim, Eitz HaDaas. And you need to know what is right about it, what's wrong about it. Where does the internet become bad? Where does it become necessary? Where is it productive or not? There's a gray area. It's obviously easy to say that the schmutz and this and that. But when you ask somebody, how much time did you spend on it? And how productive was it? And how much did you get out of it? In a base medrash, it's sharper. And I'll explain to you why the problem is sharper. It's because, first of all, the essence of learning, certainly the way my chinuch has been, whether it's learning Gemara, Halacha, Agada, is sitting over something and cracking open another shell and another shell and another shell, going over it again and again till the svara begins to seep out, till the tam begins to come out. That requires, that's the antithesis of Googling. It's the anti-Google. It's the you know, I guess ilug. I can't explain. It's the antithesis of having 2.5 million references, meaningless references at your fingertips that teach you nothing, and then your fingers are already itching for the next thing. I have letters. I saved up letters that I've written to close chaver, and chaver wrote to me 40 years ago from yeshiva. They're still treasures at my oldest daughter's sheva brachas. My best friend in the yeshiva was Rabbi Teichman from Baltimore, Rabbi Teichman, made a shevrach to my oldest daughter, and he took out the letters and read them, and they were as moving and as meaningful. This is just, I don't know, 20 years down the line, 22 years down the line, as they were b'shaito. I took time for me to write it. I put feeling and thought about it. We were very close chaverim, and we went to Lakewood, and so we wrote to each other, and it's a treasure. I mean, the only place where they would read your text messages is at a court when you're on trial for insider trading. That's the only avenue for reading text messages. You know, yes, Moreno Rabbeinu wrote yes. No way. You know, like there's nothing there that has any teichen. And kids are robbed of the ability to sit and to read something. Forget about Lahavdol Fabdolus. Mr. Sevier is here. Mr. Sevier is the resident scholar by us. How many kids could take something classic and sit down and read through it and get something out of it? How many could do it today? But it's a trend, what?
10%.
Yeah. It's how many would feel enchanted to sit down and to be able to take words and to savour them and to get a feeling out of it? So it has destroyed us. And I think if a kid begins to understand it, at least, you know, and I think that's a message. And if I tell, you know, I will tell most times, you know, parents, by us, again, it's a very broad range of kids. And you can't insulate the kids, but you can mechanech them. And one of the things I think is effective is if a kid is a certain age already, he's 14 years old, and he wants to play computer games or whatever. I can't keep up with all the boxes that come out. But so sit down with the kid and say, okay, where does this belong? How much of it do you think gives you? And how much of a waste of time? It's not a waste of time. If you want to relax, fine. So that's something that's good. People relax. But what percentage of time shall we allocate in your day, in your week, to relaxing? What things do we want to keep away from? A lot of times the kid himself, if he feels that you're not playing a game with him, will say, well, I don't think killing stuff is good. I don't think more than 10%, very few kids will tell you, I think 50% of my time should be spent on relaxing, on chilling out. I mean, most kids that aren't able, and you, if you take the kid along in the process and you're fairly honest, I think they'll be quite responsive. Now, I don't think you need to bring that into Lakewood or even Baltimore. If the environments there are more secluded, then there's no need to do it. But when the environment is not, you need to sit down. And so technology, for me, another thing almost also, I mean, we're talking about it, cell phones and texting. My brother-in-law, two of them actually learned in Beis HaTalmud. Beis HaTalmud was old-fashioned in the old-fashioned days. Beis HaTalmud was the turn of the century, not 2000, but 1900 in America in 1960. And he was sitting with the Mashgiach, Reb Chaim Vissaka, my brother-in-law, and speaking to him. And the telephone rang. And Reb Chaim Vissaka, nothing. He said, here. And once, have a second time. And he thought maybe he doesn't hear him. He said, Reb Chaim, the telephone. He said, ich bin der Balabas auf dem Telefon. Nit er of mir. I'm the balabais of the phone. A phone is a tool of mine. I don't jump to it. But what does it mean that I'm constantly waiting to see if it's buzzing or not? If I'm a doctor on call, my wife is going to husband imminently, yes, then I'm mishubit. If not, you be a balabas on yourself. There's an hour a day when you answer the phone. There's a time when you check your messages. There's not, you're not trading stocks. I don't know how many remember. Again, I'm dating myself. In my days, the Batlanim, they had three telephones in the base medrash on the hallway, and they used to go check their stocks. They were always by the phone. But that was the cell phone in my days. Some of them lost a quarter in the telephone. That was as far as they got with it. That was the investment. That was the net return. When the phone made a mistake and returned an extra quarter, that was the only thing they got out of it. But you know, it's something that in a Beis Medrash where we're trying to mechanech people that they are masters over their time and their inyanim, and they can use das in a fundamental way. It's a bigger problem because it relates to the fundamental message, and it's something that takes a little maturity to understand. So for me, the understanding, there's the Alatanya writes someplace in one of his letters or short mamorim, I don't remember. I saw it inside. He said Chachma was much bigger in the old days. They didn't have steamboats in those days, and they didn't have telegraph lines, and he lists the technology. He said, Adarabba. He said, Greeks were interested in trying to understand the fundamental issues of the world, the basis for the world. Technology is a shortchanging of chachma. It's, okay, how to use this and this. But the real chachma is to understand what this is, and where it comes from, and so on. So he said that the drive for chachma has become greatly diminished. I think people need to understand a person is a master of himself. He's a master of his environment. That's the basis for avodas Hashem and Musar. And a person should make the decision of this. Do I need to be on call 24/7? Do I need to share everything about myself with other people? So that everything has to be Facebook and Twitter and so on. Where's myself? Where am I? I think there needs to be a chinuch in terms of the more basic midas of it. Yes? That's
what I thought. The goal for tefillah, in pirush milos.
I mean, I would think, I'm not sure, it's hard for me to tell where people are holding in terms of Pirush HaMilos. You know, if a kid doesn't understand the words in davening, obviously he can't daven. But I think it's
spoken by... Kid, when kids in the youngest grades are learning davening, they should be learning with what the words mean?
But I think it's better to give a sense of its meaning rather... In other words, if you speak to a kid about Refa'enu and you mention people that are not well and we ask because what should we... I think it's sometimes more productive than touching each word, because touching each word becomes a very dry and technical drilling, and it's hard for him to associate feelings with it. So I would think that more a sense when you speak about... If you tell a story in a class about an unfortunate situation, and then you say, and if we were to daven about it, and we were to say this and this, you know, to feel what we said, I think when you learn to associate feelings with davening, it would become a lot more meaningful.
Sukkah is in there too. I had a student who said to me this year, said, we say the same sukkah as everyone. We're saying, okay, God is great, and we say all of these different paragraphs, and that's what we're saying every day, the same thing. So, is it a goal to try to have it? I mean, some of it seems like poetics, whatever, the
halukos
is the goal.
My sense is poems stick to poetry. In other words, stick to the feelings behind it. Look around the world and so on. And I thought it was just a very fascinating story. Rav Moshe Shapiro was once schmoozing with him about Rav Meir Chodesh had passed away. Rav Meir was from the Old Slobodkas. It was a different style of Musa than what Rosh Shapiro and the contemporary Machshava things. It was old Musa with Tziur and so on and so forth. So he's told over, he was once standing behind, it was some sort of Mesiba, and Rav Meir Chodesh was there. And next to him, I think, was a Rav Dov Maini. He was an old Slabatka of Mayani, Mem Ayin Yud Nun Yud. And they were talking, the Olam was singing something. I think the nigun was on the words of Nei Yisrael Am Kroivei Haluka. I think it was the nigun. I don't think they were discussing that. I think they were singing that. But Moshe was standing behind him so he could catch the conversation. And one turned to the other and he said, "Ihr hört, you hear? Liv Nei Yisrael Am Kroivei. Klal Yisrael closer." And they both started shedding tears. And Moshe Shapiro said, "And I realized that they're speaking a language that I just don't begin to understand." In other words, they lived with the richness of the words. You know, for us, it's like when you hear something touching, somebody doesn't understand what it's about, he's not going to catch why did those words trigger such emotion. I think the issue is more that we're not in tune with emotions. We don't have a sense, we don't live enough things, and the regage we do have tends to be kind of cheap and silly and so on. There's not a sense, I think the Chacham is to find settings of regage and associate it with a tefillah. I think it'll make a big... There was something I was in this orator, I didn't say it over a lot of Tisha B'Avs, and I was orated a few years ago, Tisha B'Av, and from then on, a lot of times it comes to my lips. If we're to ask ourselves, what is L'chol HaDeis, the downtime in davening on Shabbos? Like, if you got to tell somebody a pshat you heard, if you got to go outside for a few minutes, if you want to chop a kiddush when you shouldn't, what's the perfect downtime? Avarachmim. Halachically, Avarachmim, no din of being mafsik, and, you know, it's put in quite late as davening goes, and it's not a din of ashur, it's a din of kind of tefillah, and it's not a din this. It's Avarachmim. You know, it's the Avarachmim, if you think about it, Avarachmim was the takana for Jewish communities like ours that were sitting Shabbos and davening, the kids running around with Kiddush, and someone came and destroyed those communities. And we keep the Zecher and Klal Yisrael lenetzach by saying, Rabbi Shalom, it's the nicest time for Kehillah is now. After Kriyas HaTorah, Brave Amad Yisrael, everybody's here. And there were communities like this that were butchered tens and hundreds of thousands of times all across the world. I mean, but if you think about it, you know, Tzakas HaNovim, think of the Tzakas HaNovim, all of the Doros of kids, you know, if we think about it, it makes it much harder. I know how luckily the best place to leave is 10, but but since I've spoken about it, it bothers me, you know. But it's very hard if you don't, if you say the words, but if you associate, if you say a story, and then if you tell a story, you know, about one of the many epics in Klal Yisrael, whether it's the Crusaders or Khmelnytsky, whether it's Spain, whether it's pogroms in Russia, whether it's the Fogel family in Eretz Yisrael, whether it's any one of tons of times when in Chevron Mask, when you had a community that was Kehila was decimated, and you say this is the time of the week when we say Ribbono Shalom, the beauty of a community sitting together reminds us that it gives it a different time. You know, I've ruined it for myself. I have a hard time without a rachim now. But I think you need to associate it with the davening, with things like that, and then the kids will want to learn the words themselves. If you ever see when you play a catchy niggun, and everybody wants to read the lyrics, you know, because you're so filled with the regish for the music. What are the words to it? If you teach the words first, it doesn't go. But when they hear a song, the kids will always go. The adults will always go look up the lyrics because they like it. I think it's the same thing over here also.
What's the answer to a kid who says, "I can do all this stuff in 5 minutes"? It all says the same thing anyway. Now I'll say one.
Well, tell him okay, again. I don't know the age of the kid. I don't know the quality of the kid.
7th grade.
So you could tell him, you know, do you ever sit down with a friend and have a discussion that you enjoy? You probably could give over the information you give over within 5 minutes or less. But it's an experience to be together and to enjoy it. It can be that way. This is what HaKadosh Baruch Hu. The words are a way to do it, and if you would sit and think about it, it would become enjoyable. And you need to work on it. We need to work on it. It's hard for everybody because constant regish is not an easy one. But, you know, I think if a kid is mature, 7th grade, I think there's already a beginning of maturity to do that. They could do it. You know, so. And you know, for instance, let me give you an example. When you sing out of kumzitz, if kids get turned on, if you can find words in tefillah to say, you know, all the feelings we're pouring out now, they actually are in the davening of, you know, you know, they're the davening. And as you learn to associate it, you can have it. Yes, sorry?
I just want to point out, I had a lot of success. I teach 5th grade. Just basic fundamentals. So keep discussing in class about what a tefillah is, standing in front of the Ribbono Shel Olam, the opportunity that you have, who the Ribbono Shel Olam is. And these are things that I think a lot of people don't think about when they down, and certainly not the kids themselves.
What do you teach them?
And there's something, of course, they're taught to think about everything, but it's not something when they're in the younger grades. They're taught the words and everything, and through the song and everything, but it's not, you know.
See, it's a little easy. Yeah. I don't want to, you know, it's a kid who's coming to TI in Church of Later. He's coming from a background where the message was davening is very important. But the kid, what? Not necessarily.
No, not necessarily.
Because in the struggles of some of the other schools is, I mean, the dogma of his father is somebody that's not davening, and it doesn't even get the message. It's not that the kid knows it's important, but doesn't is not there yet. He doesn't really have it yet. But if you tell me talk about that, then I hear. It's, I mean, that's a.
Not necessarily. You know, there are many kids like that, but not necessarily true.
Uh-huh.
Not necessarily true, but. Feel that that's something that the kids could start relating to, at least at that age, and does make a big difference. Because then that's just the foundation to explain to them what we're saying, what you're saying, all this stuff, what's it all about.
Yeah.
You're approaching the creative, the whole entire world, and there's many, many needs over here. So before you do that, you have to lay the foundation for that. It has to. With all the ideas are a cutter of what it's all about. I mean, it's just, you know, just
right.
Build off of that. But I think it was very important to keep, I mean, it's something that I keep repeating throughout the year, of course. It doesn't happen just for one time. What are we doing? And, you know, kids talk during the evening. I said, at least that much you should understand that you're standing in front of the branch. So you may not understand anything that you're saying, but at least stand there with the proper, with
right.
The proper cover, with the proper respect, at least some idea of what you're doing. And you know, that's, you know, the type of ideas that I
Ashka? Hi. Sorry, someone else? Somebody raised their hand?
Something with Rebbe saying, it's not done. I mean, schools, Hadar, they daven before, it's
a hard one. There are a lot of reasons why it's hard. Let me give you one or two of them. First of all, you usually choose a Rebbe based on how well he teaches material. And it requires a certain level of chachman, a certain level of teaching abilities. It doesn't necessarily correlate with an ability to give over regish appreciation. It may or may not. So A, lav davka, that's why when you look for somebody, I mean, Shmuelke Brazil once came to the high school by us and wowed the kids. The first question you ask a Rebbe is not, do you have a guitar, and can you do a kumzitz? It's not the type of questions that you should get. And that's the mitzvah, so that's one. The second one is also, learning by its nature can be done in a pre-planned, regimented way. Today we're going to learn the first parasha. We're going to learn this pasuk. We're going to chazer over this nap. Today we're going to have a very, very meaningful kumzitz. It almost begs for being spontaneous, but in a school you need to plan it. So you plan a Shabbaton, you plan things like that. But it's a harder thing. Regish is tough to pre-program. So that's why it's one of the things that are tough to do.
And that's true. But what Rebbe's saying is very revolutionary in the sense that it doesn't require a Kumsitz, but it requires a story or something that the kids could relate to, not just. Just every day you say the words, that's not necessarily so hard without the English.
Right.
And that's just not done.
Listen, there are a lot of obstacles. I don't know, what can I tell you? It's a problem. It's a problem. It's not when I was young, for instance, my father took me to Chassidus. My father was a real Litvak. I mean, he came from Kovno, he owned Slabodka. You can't get more Litvish than that. But my father would have to be Baal Regish, and he would, every so often Friday night, he would take me by my hand. We'd walk across the Williamsburg Bridge, we'd go to Satmarov, we'd go to Kloisenbergerov. And as a child, it was very, very deeply impressive. By us, the kids go to Skver, and they're very, very, it's a moving experience for them. Chassidish places have the warmth, have that type of thing. And it's something. Reb Chaim Shulevitz used to say over, speaking about regish and so on, Reb Chaim had a very powerful and picturesque way of describing himself. Reb Chaim's personal tension, one of his personal tensions was, he was a grandson of the Navardika, and as such, he was a very powerful baregish, and had a definite natia for regish. On the other hand, he was a tremendous Baal Seichel, and didn't agree with Navardika with a lot of things. He didn't really learn Navardic. He was a Yosef from a very young age. His uncle was Rav Avrom Yafin, and he used to go to him occasionally. And he would stay a few days in Navardic and go back to Grodno. So Reb Chaim described it in the Musar Shmuz. A few times he said, I don't know if you heard, Reb Chaim had a very clipped way of speaking. He said, "As is kalt in Dresden, darf man sich anwärmen." When it's cold outside, you have to warm up. Navardic had the warmest stove in Europe. But if you stay too long, you burn to a crisp. You don't stay too long. He said, you have to leave. But when it gets cold again, you have to come back. And it's one of, it's one of those, and Reb Chaim sort of expressed that it's something that you can't, it can't be a constant, it should not be constant, but it should be, it's a very vital part of your life. That was the sort of the way he gave description to that. And Yeshiva also was very interesting. Reb Chaim would occasionally stoke the flames. He would get annoyed at sort of a lack of regish, and he would come up and pump up the Musar Shmuz, the Musar Seder or the Davening, but it was always spiking. That was his only tea also. He could be powerfully, powerfully merugish, and then sort of let things go. That was his natia, but very interesting way of describing the. But he said he had to go. He said the Mir didn't give it to him, and Grada didn't give it to him. Navardic gave it to him. Yes, Navardic was hot. Navardic was warm.
I think that we should be teaching current events. You mentioned the phones up. Is it only special events? That students should be made out of. Generally, they don't seem to know very much what's going on.
Well, the sports section, if that counts, is usually quite good at that. Reb Nochum told me once, he was speaking about, there's a very, very, very big tzaddik in Bnei Brak, Mamish, from Lamador Sadikim, who was an American boy, grew up as an American boy, and because he was the son of a reshiva, he was together with the Mir Oilam when they were here for the year or two in East Brooklyn, in East New York. And Reb Nochum said about him, he says, I remember him, he said, very American boy, he said, he used to memorize these columns of numbers in newspaper. I'm not sure what it was, but he said it was these long columns, they were a sport. I think, again, it really depends on the setting. And there are different nitiyas, and I can't, again, a little muscle. There were Gdolim and somebody like a Baruch Ber who really felt you should be totally excluded from the world. It's worthless. It's nonsense. It's misleading, and it's betzim. You're dealing with chayei olam. This is chayei shah, and it was a very, very insistent cutting off. Not to read newspapers. Not having to do with it. A nitik from the world. Somebody is in business. He has to read newspapers. Read newspaper. But there was a certain train of thought. There were others as well. I mean, anyone who's very famous, Mendel Kaplan, anyone who was in Philadelphia, he used to bring in the New York Times sometimes, he used to read and explain something, talk about it. And Rebellia once said, there are quite a few Rebbeim that can teach a Ketzayis. The only one that can teach a newspaper is, and he meant it, Rebellia didn't stand. I mean, if he didn't like it, he wouldn't have made teaching there. But it takes a certain level of, the Bochum have to sense that it's not your default setting, that a Gemara is your default setting, and I mean, my Reb Nochum, you could always talk to him about the sugya, occasionally you could talk to him about the newspaper. In other words, but it's the opposite. You always talk about the newspaper, occasionally about the sugya. He, you know, Reb Nochum was shakun learning first and foremost, and then he would... And it's a question of you need to be able to give over some perspective on it, that you're teaching a child a valuable insight in how you look at things, and it has to be something that's genuine, where you open your eyes, it's something where the kids don't think, oh, he gets paid to say that. You know, it has to be something that it definitely for most everybody here, where the kids are not isolated and insulated. Talking about occasion in a meaningful way where you're able to give over some shiv nashkaf is important. I remember Reb Chaim Shulevitz had a sister, he had an aunt, Reb Zinyafin was the Alter Vadik's daughter. She lived underneath my shvara's house in Slonim 11. It was two blocks from the yeshiva, and she lived to be about 100. I mean, she was in the late 90s when she was nifta. She was sharp and clear. She was a brilliant woman, very sharp. You didn't want to start off with her. She was needle sharp, very, very. And Reb Chaim had a sister, Reb Zingittel, who lived in the building, the yeshiva. She had been married to Reb Chaim Zeffinger. They were related twice. And she lived in the building. She was a very big tzaddikus, very tumimistic later. Her first husband had been a big nevardika. And she would go for Shalosh Shuddis, all the ladies of that club would come to Reb Zinyafin to talk. And my roommate was Rafal Shulevitz, who was a niece of Reb Zinyafin, so, a nephew of Reb Zinyafin. So I knew, you know, so he would tell me over sometimes. It was sometime when Johnson had died, President Johnson had died, and she had read all about him in the Modia, and she sat and gave perspectives on what you can learn from that person's life, on where he'd come from, what he'd made of himself, how he'd made himself, and so on. And Reb Zagidl came back and she told her, you know, there's nobody in the world today that can read a newspaper the way the Mumma, so it's called the Mumma, the aunt, reads a newspaper. To be able to say, and let's forget what the world's affected with. Let's see, here's a person who was a sin person. These were the challenges of faith. I overcame it. This is where it led him to. These are the issues that he came up with. It was a very, you know, but there has to be a sense that it's coming with some sort of moral perspective on it, some sort of Torah perspective on it.
Knowing for the sake of knowing what's going on in the world.
I assume they should be doing that Lemuri Chol. I assume that a kid in the academy, which, I mean, if he doesn't know current events, mitzad that, then the English department is doing a bad job. I can't imagine, you know.
I don't think there's any class called current events on every class.
So certainly the Gemara class shouldn't be the place for that. So let the history teacher do it. He shouldn't be learning American history, then in current events during Gemara. But a perspective, and especially when our perspective is contrary to the world, where the world is wowing X, Y, or Z, and let's give an example, and let's say when the English prince got married, and it was all over the papers ad nauseum. I think it's time to them to say, why is it that people so infatuated with it? You know, it used to be a king had responsibilities. He made decisions. A king, where somebody makes no decisions, leaves an empty life, useless. And draining the blood of everybody else, and running. Why is it that we don't even say this? Why waste words on it? Why is the world so infatuated with things that glitter and have no? It's one thing when a king, the Tsar of Russia, he could have been the most evil person, but the man ruled about a third of the world, and you know, for good or for bad, the power was real. You make a bracha on a person like that. On the king and the prince of England, maybe Mishan Abrias, but nothing more than that. There's no shechilik, not you know, shechilik mikvodo or mechachmaso, certainly not. So why is it that, you know, why is the world infatuated with something that's just tinsel? And isn't this, don't we become affected by it? It's a place to make, how many of you have, you can ask it, how many, why is it important? Why is it in significance? Why is it, it's we learn to appreciate things that are just, that's a point to make. And again, it has to be made in a way where they don't know always what to expect from you. It has to be done with seichel. But yes, it's something where you can sort of give a perspective. We have a perspective on the world. And
what you said, really, it should be an obligation of a Rebbe to do that. Otherwise they're going to get the hashkafa from their parents. Or from their
citizens. So it depending on their world and what their world is. So what you should tell in Lakewood is not the same as what you should say in Sheir Sol, it's not the same as what you should say in the academy. Each one has their world, their issues, and what you can tell them. You know, that's why it's different. But part of what a Rebbe, it, just like halacha lemaisa, when you learn halacha with kids, you're learning how to apply it. You're learning hilchas adal minim, and then you take out a lul menesik. There's a certain, you're applying our hashkafa to look for things that are toiv and emes, has a way to apply itself to the world. Has a way to apply itself, and kids need to understand that. Yes.
I'm a little confused.
I'm a lot.
I might be in some cloud, but when there was a coronation, I had my kids all watch the video because I felt it was important. My wife's English, so different, but. I still remember that when I went to England for the first time, the Queen spoke on the radio. My father did not have television. Well, everyone stood up. What's coming? And I sat down and I was like, my future wife said to me, "What are you doing? What am I doing?" Because I was in the United States. There's no Kavod HaMalchus. So when people could see it, they could learn Kavod HaMalchus when you see a coronation.
Again, if that's what you think, and again, you're entitled. If you suddenly say, let's do away with stuff, but there's malchus and there's a music of malchus, as long as you're interpreting it for them, if you're doing a certain malach of interpreting it, and somebody once telling me, a neighbor of mine in Israel, Moshe Cohen, he was once telling us, you know, all the stories that you hear from the old days are meaningless for you. A king, a czar. He says, do you want to know what a king is? You know what a czar is? He said, when they built the new train terminal in Warsaw, it was like, it's supposed to be very common. The czar came to look at it. He said, the czar looked at it, and he said, you know, like, the next day, the architect jumped off a building. He said, you don't understand, you don't begin to understand that. Fine. As I'm saying, but I again, there's, I have no problem with that perspective. if it's a perspective that you thought about and you're explaining to them that, you know, Malchus is Choshev and even, you know, Achav, Elior ran before him and so on, that's also, but that's, you're giving a perspective. You're not watching the movie to see the fun and the thing. Any perspective is fine. It's as a Rebbe, the Yeshua, you have different days. I don't. There's not a problem with different, but it's a day of somebody who has a Torika perspective, thought about it, and he's giving that over to the kids. That's Orchas Chaim. Yes. Okay. I think we solved all the world's problems. And we're good to go. We had lunch suppers around the corner. Yes.
What's the perspective, objective more, to teach boys, let's say older boys in Chumash, learning with them? What's the good thing to focus on?
There's two main inyanim, the two main approaches. There is the, and again, this depends a lot on kids, where they, A, which kids, and B, where is this Chumash Seder coming through? Where is this Chumash Seder coming about? I think one thing that's important is to teach, I don't know how to say it the right way. If you take a look at the more modern versions of Chumash today, it's Chumash is almost like an inkblot. Whatever you want, you could say. You can project any narrative you want. If you learn through a Ramban, we showed him on Chumash in Yeshiva Shabbos morning by Kiddush. I mean, someone said the Ramban to Rashi on Chumash is like Tosis to Rashi on. The Ramban doesn't say things. He'll bring a half a dozen rayas where the word is used. The seriousness, it's a sugya. What's the pshat in this over here? It's not how do you feel about it. It's there's a raya, there's a kasha, there's a way matrik. So one element of Gedolei Rishon, of the Ben Ezra, the Rashi, the Ramban, and you know, the seriousness of learning of the Inyan. And, you know, Rashi Malach is this, Ramban has the problems from here and here, the Meili says this. That's one. It presents a certain. The trend today is anything you say goes. It's a certain lack of gravitas on the Chumash, and it gets worse in certain areas, by certain communities, but it's bad. And I think just being able to go through a Ramban and understanding a Kasha and a Teretz and a Raya and one or two Mahalchim, I think that's very important. And then there's a second chelik, which is what the Baal Musa did, to try to learn up what is this teaching us. The stories of Chumash are meant to teach us Orchas Chaim. They're meant to teach us how a person does something. And you need to somehow introduce it in a way that they can relate to it to some degree. That's what Baal Musa did. They painted a picture in a way where these are mahalchim. I remember I once heard Rabbi Gedalia Eisman in Kol Torah, Mei Vesrim. I used to walk every week to buy to hear him. He was awesome. He once said, Yukach no mat mayim. He said, let's get the picture straight. Avram was an old man, a patriarch. Yishmael was a young boy, relatively, and not from his, you know, not from his chosher wife either. And he says, look at how he speaks to him. Yukach, he doesn't say kach, take. He says it would be nice, you know, someone ought to take, no, please, ma'at, a little water. How does a person speak? How does a person speak to help? Yukach, no, ma'at, mine. Three words giving over their heart to the person. It's stuck in my mind. It's. I must have heard it in the 70s, in the early 70s, that's when I went there, and I still remember it. It's to, you know, how you talk, how you address, how you, you know, so that was the Derech of Baal Musar, and it's a very important. So if you're learning the Chumash B'Torah's text, it's one thing. Learning the Chumash B'Torah's Musar element, that's another thing. And those are the two important areas I think are neglected.
Can you answer the high school student who comes to you and says, Pasha, I don't believe that the Tevet can hold all of the two pairs of all the animals, or Rift is 3 years old, and the Russian go on and on.
Right.
That sort of defy logic. And he's coming to you and saying, logic over the Torah. It's
So, first of all, you packed in a lot of animals in that little question. you said the Teva, you said the Midrashim, and the kid. The type of question like this depends very much where's the kid coming from. But the first thing is, there are two nekudas here that are sort of hidden, the hidden points. One is, I always have this, they have this new revitalization of rationalist Judaism. Rationalist. We're not mystical. So rationalist Jews don't believe in Shadim. They don't believe in Shadim and demons. But they believe in Malachim, unless they're at the Karsim. So why a Malach is a more rational type of person than a Shade, I haven't figured out yet. Creating the world from nothing. In other words, that you can make something out of nothing is not a nace. It's way beyond. It's not. So if the person says, I believe in Torah, but I can't believe this story, say, well, if you can make a person in this little cell that I, in one cell, I can't even call it, do you know how many, this I read in a book, it's called Something of Life, I got it's called, it is a not from book totally, it has nothing to do with Frumkai, it has nothing to do with Hashkafa, it's Oxford University, the only reason I have it is because it costed $3 on a sale, and I pick up stuff like that, I like it, it's about cell life, it's fascinating. A cell has somewhere between 50 to 60,000 different chemical interactions in a space that's 1 trillionth of a teva. So how, if someone were to tell you I can lock into a little cell like that, something 56,000, you'd say, that's a fairy tale. That's impossible. I'm a rationalist person. Can't be. Well, maybe can't be, but just happens to be. It's important, you know, we don't begin to understand what is, how much things that define imagination. The truth is, and again, if the kid is mature enough or smart enough, you know, quantum physics is doesn't make no sense whatsoever. It makes no sense. If things, typical stuff is where things come out of nowhere, and as long as they retain a certain stability in terms of coming and disappearing very quickly, it's okay. What does that mean? What does that mean? I don't know what it means, but that's the best picture we have of what's there. And if it's there, it's there. How does gravity work? You know, people don't even, we're so used to things. How outgoing forces work is not hard to understand. I take a ball, I throw it. I throw it hard. I throw it quickly. That works. But there's nothing we can, what pulls something? What forces something out? We have a picture. We live with a paradigm, makes sense. Everything that goes outwards goes with speed. Light goes with a speed. Gravity is instant. And how does a particle know to pull the... Every single particle in the world pulls the other particle. How? I don't know how, but it's there. So I say, listen, I don't have a grasp on everything, but I need to make a circle, this I understand, so on and so forth. If I could put in one cell, I have every single being that will ever come from me, and his tunis and nefesh are in this cell. This cell can multiply itself trillions of times and create trillions of people. So, you know, that's what it is, and it's part of those things. Because I don't understand it, is not a reason not to believe it. Because if believing was contingent on understanding, the world doesn't make sense. Things don't make sense. The more you go, the further you go out. I was reading an article recently. There's a magazine called American Scientist. It's very fascinating. I enjoy it. It's put out six times a year, and it's I think it's a Sigma Psi. It's put out by science. It's as mainstream plus as you can get. There's an article there, I have it, about the lies we teach kids in physics. And it goes through the things that you always teach in physics that are not really true. They're the best we can do, but they certainly are not right. And so the answer is, we do live and we do exist in the worlds around us, and if we don't understand that, it still is around us. People have to understand that what makes, quote-unquote, sense to you is not the outward definition of the world. And And if you so a few pieces. Torah itself is not logical in the sense that it comes from Lopez. Yesh, the Torah says Breishis Bara. Yesh Me'ain doesn't make sense, and Yesh Me'yesh doesn't make sense. That the world infinitely exists, it still doesn't make sense because it's not the comes from place. Infinite doesn't mean anything. It's a meaningless number. It's a word that means nothing infinite. So, whatever it is, we are limited and we understand bits and pieces of reality. The fact that the Torah said it's a nace, the Torah doesn't say anywhere that's teva that he put all these animals in, is it's a nace. It was a nace done to preserve the world. Within some context, it required effort. What you can do is develop the theme and say, let's try to understand it. It obviously was a nace. So why do you have to get wood together and hammer it and put pitch in and run around feeding? Why did HaKadosh Baruch Hu want it that way? This is a good way to introduce the kids to the idea of Hishtadlus and Bitachon and so on and so forth. But if you jump the gun and say it's obviously a nace, it couldn't have been in reality. So why did you need any tools really? By the way, as a Maimar Muskin, I'm just saying it for an entertainment benefit, not for the... I have a friend of mine. He's actually... He went to yeshivas with me. He's my age. He became a nuclear physicist, was bored of it. He likes everything exotic. He's not married, so he doesn't make panasa. So he researches all sorts of fascinating things. So he has a book with all the possible ways the world could be created. You know, the 6,000 years versus death. He has, I don't know, 55 different scenarios ranging from fascinating to the outrageous and crazy. And he has about the teva holding all the animals. And he works it out how it's physically possible. I'll tell you basically how he does it. I can sketch out the scheme. I can't tell you the. It goes something along these lines. That first of all, the understanding that to get all the different types of dogs, the Dalmatians with the Beagles with the Saint Bernards, you only need one type of dog. That was one point. So, how many? At what level in the at what level in the ladder of genus, species, phylum, and so on do we have a cutoff point where it's possible to get? So he hypothesizes X. I don't remember what it was. How big is that creature when it's in its just born state, and how many times its weight in food it eats? And he calculates it, and again, the details didn't interest me very much. I just thought it was a fascinating thing. And he calculates that it fits exactly. Im kabbalah with a kaplan, but I wouldn't go in that direction because I think it's more important the kid needs to understand that many of the things that Torah speaks about are not teva, and this is one of them. And we need to understand, though, what HaKadosh Baruch Hu wanted from Noah. Why did he do it a process like that? Why didn't he just take him to a mountaintop someplace out of Eretz Yisrael? Why did he, in Eretz Yisrael? Why? There's room to talk about it and to sort of jump the gun on the kid's question and say, yes, it obviously was a nace, but why was it a nace? Why didn't it go up in Teva? And so on. This, things like that. You can. Okay, yeah.
Just along the same line, so I'm not sure if I actually have my class as well, but you have to really understand how things work before you could say that that it doesn't make sense.
Right.
I felt like Zal tell us that the people sitting and learning the base medicine are the ones that are running the world. They say, it doesn't make any sense to me. I said, if you bring someone here, let's say, like from 50 years ago, and the lights go out, and tell them, so say, fix the bulb. So say, okay, that's not. You have to send someone down to the main plant over there. You have to fix the computer. So what are you talking about? You have to go over there in order to say in order to turn on the lights over here. So, yeah, because that's the way things work. So we understand that now because we're exposed to it. But if you don't understand how things work, then you can't tell me that the guy sitting in the basement is not the guy running the world. The guy who's out there doing I don't know, the world. You can't say that. You have to understand how things work. So first, you have to find out how things work in order to be able to.
So what did you want?
If someone was working at a school that has that kishah towards Medina Israel, or however they want to phrase it, how much should the Rebbe be involved with steering the kids, let's say, right out of scuff of what's happening, say, in the elementary or in the irreligious happenings that are occurring there?
I'm not sure that those two, there are two things. First of all, there's an issue of an approach to Medina Israel, which is issue one. The other inyanim don't have to. There's not a necessary correlation automatically between the two. There are schools that have a very positive attitude towards B'nai Yisrael and a very, you know, isolationist, insulationist, chadal, whatever you want to call it, you know, klapi. It doesn't correlate. Generally speaking, when a Rebbe is, you know, there are touchy issues, because when you sign up to teach for somebody, you're agreeing to a certain element of, yes, this is the school, these are its shittas and its dais, and I'm meant to teach within those parameters. A person needs to be concerned, when is he doing something shalom kishur simply because he's being employed on one context and he's doing something other than that. On the other hand, it's lav dafka that what the world has begun. In other words, just because a person has a very positive attitude towards Medinat Yisrael in terms of, you know, supporting it and being part of it and so forth, does it mean that mixed groups of boys and girls are okay? It's perfectly fine to be a very loyal Zionist and to say, but this is wrong. It's, one has no shy to the other. A person needs to be honest. What is school? You know, you're working for somebody. You're agreeing to something or getting employed. You need to separate the core hashkafas from all the shaft that has accumulated with it and steer the kids. And a lot of times, if you speak about the, for instance, let's say you're in an environment that is not in favor of Kolo or doesn't preach it, you can, but if you present the dogma of Torah, if you talk with great admiration, genuine admiration of Gedolei Torah and who they were and what their lives were like, it automatically draws people. You know, if you speak about what the, you know, I remember when Shlomo Zalman was there and the Israeli media couldn't figure out what was going on, why 300,000 people came to Levaya, ranging from Strymel through Kippot Srugot to a man who lived in two rooms in Shari Chesed and, you know, didn't have, he was a retired Rashiva called Torah, didn't know anything about it. It made a tremendous impression. You know, we tell kids about the type of Mrs. Nefesh for Torah, the type of Hasmah, the type of Galus of Torah, it creates an ideal. And it should not be, there's no reason the world, politics creates strange welding of all sorts of shittas and days. They don't have to go together. A very powerful and strong appreciation of the United Soul. There's no reason in the world why that needs to deride Gadlus and Torah. There's not no reason, just because the type of people that clumped together were A, B, or C. Just like a knitted yarmulke, it could be Rabbi Allah Chassid also. There's no reason why a knitted yarmulke is if you believe in this Israel, you should wear with knitted yarmulke, and if not, you should wear black velvet yarmulke. And if with a, you know, depending on a setup or not a setup, that's also like two different shittas. It doesn't have to go together. And I think there's a broad room where kids can learn what's right, and you have a lot to offer, even if you disagree on point A, point B, point C. You know, it doesn't have to work. You have this situation where you have Litvisher Rebbeim teaching Siddush Yeshivas. You may not believe in going to Tish, you may not like the over-infatuation with the Rebbe, but if you agree to teach there, then you're not going to be knocking the Rebbe. What you're going to be doing is inspiring the Bachrim to like learning, to get into learning, and you hope that will create a necessary, you know, balance that will give the kid what it needs. I think, you know, but you have to be honest. When you take on a job and you sign on, you take money from somebody, you have this thing. There was a certain place that just stroll within the yeshiva world, but it had its own shittas about various issues in Kirov and so on. A lot of Rebbeim didn't buy into it, which was fine. But they would actively sort of push the kids away and tell them that their Rosh Hashiva is wrong. I thought that was a very, very dishonest and was wrong. You can resign your job, or you can say, listen, he may say X. My job is to inspire him in Torah, and once he gets into Torah, he'll see things differently. That's fine. But not to go. I mean, there's something very dishonest about it, and I think fundamentally it's wrong. I don't. That's.
Are you saying that if I teach the school that's pro-Zionist, I can't redefine Zionism in the classroom so that everybody said, I don't think anyone in this room is not a Zionist.
Listen, if you teach, let's take an example like that. If you teach in a class and you tell them and you inspire them with how much Eretz Yisrael is the only place where there's Hashras Hashchina, it's the only place where a person can fully realize himself as such, but it's Shmiras HaMitzvahs and the religious awareness is what the Teichen is about, then it creates a model that's true. And it doesn't, and you may, you know, other things are necessary for it, but it's a very different attitude than if someone employed you for X and you really going against sex. I don't know. It's not a. What my feeling is that in a case like that, in a case, if you give students the right tmuna about it, they'll have the right picture about it. Like I said, you know, if Eretz Yisrael is the makom for Klal Yisrael because it's the place where Hakadosh Baruch Hu is the closest kesher for Klal Yisrael, where the hashkacha of Hakadosh Baruch Hu was mostly Klal Yisrael, and so on and so forth, and Eretz Yisrael is mechayev. A different level of ruchnius and goodness, then you're giving the right message.
I want to say Yoshita, so to speak, right? Sorry, guys. I taught in a school with Ben Gurion's picture in the classroom. I took it down and I replaced it with Rav Cook's, which I didn't put Chassidish Rebbe there. Right?
Okay,
that's. I didn't put Rav Zalman there.
Okay.
Right? And the principal of the school walked in one day, looked at it. And didn't say a word, and never said a word to me for the rest of all.
That's fine.
I can't imagine.
Exactly, I can't imagine where somebody should have a problem with that. As you know, we are Zionists through the eyes of Rav Kook, not through the eyes of Ben Gurion. Ben Gurion was a man with, you know, who had a lot of mundane accomplishments, but as a person to emulate and admire, he's not. And if they had no problem with it, then you did the right thing. It would have been a problem, and again, I'd be very frank, if he would have insisted that you replace it back again, I don't know. I don't know if I'd feel comfortable teaching when you hang up somebody's picture, you're saying it's about the person. And, you know, kazera a vikadesh. And, you know, that would be a very difficult situation. I don't know. I don't answer that. That's a tough one. You know, we have it also, kids... by also occasion go teach in conservative or reform Sunday schools, and it's an issue of what is it that you can do, what is it you can't do, what is it you can say, what is it you can't say. Each environment, they're very different. You can accomplish a lot, but it can't be at the price of rank, you know, of Gezel Gomer or Shekhar Gomer. You have to use a lot of seichel. Yes.
What does Rebbe do when he's teaching yeshiva? And because he's interacting with the boy day in, day out basis, he knows the boy's bachur, whatever it is, better than, let's say, the Hanhala, who's not interacting with him. And he feels very strongly that this boy could shine more in another place. And the Hanhala is adamant that he can't throw the boy to the Aramaisa. But in the Rebbe's conscience, like it's in the boy's best interest to leave, how does the Rebbe deal with that?
So there's two levels, two or three levels, and this is a question that's across the board, everywhere, all the time. I don't think if you're employed by Yeshiva X to tell a bacha leave the yeshiva when you're forbidden to do so by Dan Hola is a real issue. If the bacha comes and asks for advice, to tell him wrong advice you can't do. Sheval Tais is also something. You can tell somebody, listen, if a bar comes to you, and again, I'm you know, there's a Yaakov Avinu was the one who had to struggle with this. A bar comes to you, a kid, and says, can I leave the yeshiva? Or his parents come to you, should I go to a better place, a stronger place? If you say, I feel that being that I'm in this Moisin, I'm a Rebbe here, I can't answer that question for you. I want to tell you a maisa that to me was a personal story, but it was an extraordinary story, a lesson in a certain emes. When I was a high school boy, I was struggling with the issue of going off to yeshiva, which in those days meant not going to college. They way before BTLs were born, and those days you had to do college and do it b'chol moide, b'chol nafsho. You had to do it the way it should be done, and it wasn't. And going off to yeshiva was a struggle, and obviously it was something which my parents were very unhappy with, and society didn't encourage it terribly, and it wasn't good for a shidduch not to go to college in those days, and so on. So I had to go, and I was struggling with it. It was very difficult. And I went to ask Rav Henkin a shaila. Rav Henkin lived on Lower East Side. I hope everybody has heard of Rav Henkin. And I'm not surprised because he didn't have a party behind him, and he didn't have. And Rav Henkin was one of the poskei hador. My parents were close. My father was very close to him. My father held the world of him. He used to come once a year to make an appeal. He was a block away from my house, and he was a tzaddik straight out of the storybooks. I mean, when I knew him, he was in his 90s. He was frail. He was pure MS. He was blind already, but he corrected my father on Trump. You know, he could read everything about Per, and he was a very, very unique person. So I called him up and I said, "I'm my father's son. Can I come over and ask the Rav Shailas?" He said, "Of course." So I come in and I ask him, "Should I go to college or go to Tzolt Yeshiva?" So a tremendous look of tsar in his face came, and he said, I would have told you not to come if I knew that was a question." And he said, "Listen, his son was a very successful lawyer from Yid, an Halacha Yid, and his grandson is an Eretz Yisrael, a Rav. His son was a lawyer. He said, had my children gone the way I wished, I could have answered you. But it's not like that. And Chas v'Shalom, I have no kindness. They're wonderful, wonderful children. Chas v'Shalom, I don't think I have any kindness. But if they didn't, so can I answer you? And Chas v'Shalom, don't think that I don't have any kindness. They're very, very fine people. But since they didn't do that, how can I tell you?" It was very powerful to me, the Midas Emes. Like, a lot of people had kindness in those days. Rabbanim is going back to history. And their children, they sent to college. Everybody else's kid, they sent to yeshiva, which was unfortunate. The Rabbanim's kids knew what it was like to hunger and to wait for yeshiva check. In those days, you have to check the year the check was written out. It wasn't a question of the date. It was, they would be 6 months behind, 8 months behind. It's sad. That was the story. So a lot of their kids did go. The Talmidim were inspired to stay in learning. So he said, It was to me, and I also got my answer. I also had the tshuva. If you tell a boy, and if the boy is anything about das, it's wrong for me working for this mindset to tell you to go someplace else. So if you've answered the question and you know what's right, or if you say I need to recuse myself from this issue because I'm going to get a bedover, there's nothing wrong with saying I can't answer. If there's an occasional need, send somebody else. In other words, if you really feel that it's pikuach nefesh, this kid needs to go someplace else, send a third party, the rav of that boy, and say, "Listen, I'm a rebbe here, I'm not allowed to tell him. But I'm telling you, the situation is, he will do extremely well there, not here." It's the right way to do it. It's wrong for you to go and, my father never spoke about things or people, whatever. He was very nizer. Besides the shahari, he kept all these things. There was a certain person in Bnei Brak, a big kanoi, a group of them, two or three of them, who were employed by the Vision of Zareba. This is going back in the 50s and 60s. And they were the Rebbeim in the Vision of Yeshiva. They incited the Bachram against the Rebbe. The Rebbe is soft, the Rebbe is Mizrahi, the Rebbe is this, the Rebbe is that. And they succeeded in getting a whole group to break off. And they became known as Schwarze Visionists, Black Visionists. They became the anti-visionist vision, whatever it was. And people kind of took it with, real Chavriman. They were the Rebbeim and the Yeshiva there. They got the boys to see the Emes, whatever it was. My father once, someone made a remark, and my father-in-law said, "Yes, and that was their Hakar Satov for the Rebbe taking them off the street and when they were starving and giving them a job. that he incited the chassidim against him. That was his hakaras hatov. That was sort of blurred out. He couldn't take the l'shem shemayim of not only biting the hand that feeds you, but biting off the hand that feeds you, kind of amputating the arm that feeds you. And there was a certain element of it. You know, there's a certain Musa Haskell that teaching honesty is also something we need to teach our kids. And if I get a paycheck, I can't. So you can recuse yourself. You're not. You're in a gebedaver. It's perfectly legitimate. And find a way around. Let someone else do it. Let someone else sit down and talk with him. But you can't. I think that you cannot do it. Anyway, speak up, Piklal. It's not. You have to ask shilas to big people on these things. I have difficult issues. But yes.
The question about the woman's role in the Yiddish case.
I'm sorry?
Woman's role in Yiddish
case. Woman's role? Yeah.
I mean, we know in the system that the woman is going to be biased. It's really specific. I'll give you a couple of specific examples. Okay?
Right.
It's almost like in the Hamish world today, it's like if you'd see a woman sitting and reading Chumash, a child would be fine.
Yeah.
Is there a reason why it's not a thing to encourage a woman or wife to, instead of reading a magazine, a newspaper, to read something better, number one? And number two, for example, Rabbi Yeshiva will encourage your El Moser to introspection, Shmuzin. What is a woman's role regarding that? You know, you don't find they do that is because they can handle it, but are they here to improve themselves, to work on things, or not? What, how would you close those two things?
I think.
I could just add, in seminaries, they do that. Not supposed to.
And how long does it last?
You know? But they encourage it, and then they
and also do it. You know,
but
very often, no one wants to know when I should do my what's the answer?
Okay, so let's talk about it. I believe that life is a beis medrash that's meant to form a person, forge a person, develop a person, the nisyonos to go through, and so on and so forth. Talmud Torah is the primary vehicle for a man to attain that. So that's the nature of a man, and so on. A woman's life has a lot of interactions that produce profound changes. A Yiddish mother is who she is because she's a mother, because she's Yiddish. When a woman is taking care of children, responsible, it's not a duty. The feedback of life. And, you know, I don't think I'm all that much older than most people here, but living through life, if you understand it as such, it has a profound impact on a person, much more. I know myself, all the Musa I learned was only a preparatory ground for when you go through the Nisayan. The Nisayan is what has the impact on you. A woman becomes a kind, sensitive, understanding, / spiritual person by raising children. There is no activity in the world that imparts so much. You know, when people say only raising children, all she does is that. Even, you know, one of the things you talk about to better girls. You know, you get a girl who comes in and she wants a husband that they'll sit and work on themselves together. And very idealistic. And she means it well. You try to explain to her the care when you come home from a hard day of work and a woman thought about what can I make to eat that's enjoyable and alike and thinks about you, there's a lot more power in that than many other things. And the reason we become so insensitive to it, a Mesilas Yesharim environment is an artificial environment in many ways, and for a woman especially. The difference between women and men in Talmud Torah is because for a man, Talmud Torah can be a lot more, just the nature of it, a realistic environment. A woman that does the right thing, a woman is in a situation where she's always doing for the other. That's her metzias. And when that's the way HaKadosh Baruch Hu meant it, to bring out better people. And the great women, you know, whether or not, when you think of a great woman, you don't think of how much Mesilas Yesharim she has. It's how much care when she talks to somebody, how sensitive, how warm, all of those things. And we've lost, so for a younger person, learning is a good thing, and it's fine. But life, married life, is supposed to change that. When you have a family of kids and a lot of kids, Leonhar, and you take care of them and you live their life and you daige for them, it's just like the Chazon Ish had an issue with Musa. As I said, I don't say that because Kohar gave us Taryag Mitzvahs. If that doesn't develop us, why did he think of Slashon to develop us? That was his time. Yes, you know, I'm not going there. But his time was, it can't be that the Taryag Mitzvahs are not doing our moral development, and somebody in 250 years ago with a sefer did it. That was his time, so to speak. I mean, Kadosh Baruch Hu made a woman in a unique position where she's the one who cares, worries, lives. Her husband, her children's net. Why would that not make a different person? And somehow we've lost that. It's I have my mother-in-law. She's live and be well. She's not a well person, especially. She was a Nisr Chaznish. She was a Greinerman. She's a Greinerman. And Greinemans are all about doing, rolling up sleeves. Obviously, it's sneezed away, but you know, kind of, you know, rolling up the sleeves and doing. That was my mother-in-law. I mean, 24/7. You could always, if the husband needed to go and learn, you could always drop the kids there and this and that and so forth. Rabbi Tzinyafim, Baruch Chaim Chaim, lived right underneath her. Rabbi Tzinyafim was already an older person. Rabbi Tzinyafim was a kind of intellectual person. She was very shy, and she once told my mother-in-law, Rabbi Tzinyafim, she said, "You know, you're such a great girl, such a wonderful woman, but I have a little bit of a." Musa, a little tiny to you. Your involvement with all the kids, the grandchildren, great grandchildren, always that the house there was always kids there, always kids being parked and taken. You know, I think that they are taking away from your intellectual development. On some level, she didn't word intellectual, but she said something wrong. So my mother answered her, "Yes, as soon as we finish raising grandchildren, great grandchildren, I'm going to sit down and do some intellectual development." and you know, there was a point to the answer. You know, I don't know why a person is less developed. If we really look at things, there is nobody as good and as caring and as sensitive and as giving. You sit and learn such about being a giving person, caring person, L'shem Shemayim. When that's what you're doing 24/7, a woman, a role as a mother is selfless, dedicated, sensitive, and we believe that practicing something brings out the best in you. You know, it's like that.
If there is downtime, or you know, something that suggests. And if the question was about reading newspapers, magazines, all.
If there's downtime, a woman should relax. A woman needs to have also some sort of intellectual feed, some sort of ruchnistic input. It's important. But the reason why men have a mitzvah talmud Torah is because a man's, it's like, you know, at times at home when I had had enough of helping, when my minister chesed ran out, I would tell the kids, there's this expression in English, you know, some would say, "Abba, I need this or that." I would say, you know, "I'm a little bit tough kid. I'm off duty now." You know, mothers are not off duty. That's the difference. But so a man does get a lot, does get development from Rizcha Deraisa, from learning. That's and a woman gets it from living life. Everybody needs, just like a man needs to roll up his sleeves and do things, or else his learning is kind of idle and it's sort of up in the air. A woman needs, you know, does need learning and so on. But the midah of the amount of, and you know, and the volume of it is very different. Sorry,
what? There's a woman.
Who am I speaking to? I'm
Marvin Left.
You're from? I just.
From Rockaway, New York.
Okay, they come all from Rockaway here. That, yeah.
A woman feels a need to get into learning.
So there are plenty of opportunities that she can do it.
It doesn't take away from her role as a mother.
Then it's perfectly good to do. I'm just, you know, the question was more, when we set up a general plan for general women at general time, not the klal shabbai, you need to reinforce to a woman. When you hear it, sort of not having lived life, from a woman that growing together would mean they would sit down every day and make a cheshbon nefesh, a mesilas yesharim on the side, then you know that they haven't landed yet. the needs of different people, just like you have men, that the learning is only going to be a small portion of life. They're really very involved in chesed. They're activists and they live people's lives. That's fine. We do have to adjust it. But if we're talking about a big klal, women are not taught enough. One of the trefa things that the world teaches us today is that children are a luxury. I mean, financially they're right, but in terms of needs, you know, I may decide to have a child. In other words, you're not human until you don't raise another human being. That's how the Kadosh Baruch Hu made the Bria. That having a child is something that is you know, you're not contributing to the world by having a child. That having a child doesn't add to your own personal development. That it's not what makes you into who you are. I don't want to say the words.
President said it was a punishment.
Yeah, that's a trefa things. Halachically, until you don't have a child, you can't sit on the Sanhedrin. The midas, until they're not unlocked by developing another human being and working on him, you're not there yet. You're not an Adam HaShalom. That's a trefa, and a mother who sits on it, a mother who that's her person. It should be said, oh, she's only with the kids all day. She's not growing. What does it mean she's not growing? How do you grow? You know, the horns, like, how do you grow? You grow because for all of us who are married and you've been able to get away for day vacation and you go away and the first thing I say is, I have to call home and see what's with the kids. I'm sure this is universal problem Shalom Bayis at this time of the year. You know, I can remember all the times, Baruch Hashem, like, I have to call and see what's with the kids. Did this one eat? Did this one go to sleep? Is this one still annoyed? I said, but we're on vacation. We have 24 hours with no kids. Yeah, but I first have to check up. But that's extraordinary. You know, that's what a person is. I mean, and everyone, it's amazing. But the worst that Picarson have the nastiest and harshest things to say about their fathers and Rebbeim, and their eyes get misty when they speak of their mother. And if their mother will ask them something on a deathbed, if their father or Rebbe was on deathbed, they'll be dafka not do it. And if their mother asks them, they'll curse on the breath, but they'll do it because my mother asked it. There's something very lovable. It's halei dovahu. So I think if we'd give a picture. I mean, Rabbi Howard spoke at his daughter's graduation. He sent me a clip of it, and I watched it. He spoke at his daughter's graduation now in Beis Yaakov, and I thought it was one of the most powerful speeches. He said, with a lot of regish, it's his oldest daughter graduating, and he spoke about the role of a Jewish mother from both ends. The Mesiras Nefesh for a woman that doesn't should go to Kollel is laudable. A woman being able to develop a career is nice, but neither of the two should ever overlap. It should never cover in any way that a woman is first and foremost an Ein B'Yisrael. Whether you're talking about the ruchnis accomplishment or secular accomplishment, there is no accomplishment greater than raising and educating another human being and bringing a neshama to the world and developing it. And one needs, when one is weighing the Mesiras Nefesh for sitting in Kollel, one needs to weigh the factor of her motherhood to the children, and when one is weighing her needs for accomplishment, one needs to weigh it against it. There's no, it's the first and foremost thing is, you know, probably Badim Vim Ein Mason. That's who a woman is. That's her ruchnis development, that's her accomplishment. Someone was just telling me he was a shliach, a Chabad shliach was in a very modern community, was in, you know, introduced himself and this, and then someone asked him, and what does your wife do? So he said, oh, she runs a home for 9 unwanted foundlings. I said, wow, that's admirable. He said, they, by the way, have the same last name that I have. But people will wow. If you say you run an institution with 9 kids, and you know, it's amazing. That's it. But if it's your own kids, it's not amazing anymore. Oh, that's all she does. Wow, how repressed, how this, how that, undeveloped, you know. And yes, different women have different needs. There are women that do need to have a career. That's the mitzvahs, and you know, women need to have some learning. But to put the main focus, I think it's very important to put the focus where it should be, with emphasis. Okay.